The Tom Woods Show, episode 1818.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Delighted to welcome Gene Epstein back to the show. The great Gene Epstein. I have a lot of new listeners these days because of all my work on the virus. So there are some of you who may not know who Gene Epstein is, and he's a regular on the Tom Woods Show, and he's great. He's former economics and book review editor at Barron's, brilliant guy. He's currently the director of the Soho Forum, which is a debate series discussing issues of interest to libertarians that, of course, hasn't been having in-person events because of, you know, the authorities in New York City, but has been having debates over Zoom, and we're going to be talking about some in-person debates that are going to be resuming this very year, 2021, very, very shortly, as a matter of fact. Our topic for today is the Trump economy, and we're going to use as a springboard for the discussion a little audio clip from another podcast where people were discussing this topic, and Gene's going to take that apart, and then we're going to get his own bird's eye overview of the Trump economy and what we should think about it. Obviously, Gene is as free market an economist as you can possibly get. So that's going to be the perspective, and that's going to be the lens through which we analyze the Trump economy. So, Gene, welcome back.
Good to be back, Tom, talking to a dear and inspiring friend like you.
Oh, thank you, Gene. It's such a pleasure. And I am really happy to start this episode with a notice for everyone, whether you're in the Florida area or not, or in near the Villages, which is, I think, not too far from Orlando.
Yeah,
we have an event we want to tell you about. But really, chances are, if you live in the U.S., you're probably in a state where for much of the year, you haven't been able to do very much. You certainly haven't been able to socialize or certainly make new friends. If there's any way you can get down to Florida for what Gene's about to tell you, I don't think you're going to be sorry you did it. So go ahead, Gene.
That's right. And I'd even go beyond Tom's limited sense of geography and say that, you know, if you're in Australia, you know, if you're anywhere, you might want to come, since there are so many places around the world that are under lockdown and where it's very difficult to meet and greet people. So we're giving you enough time to book a plane flight. As you know, plane flights are dirt cheap. Hotel rooms are dirt cheap. And this is going to be in Florida. That's located in generally, but it's going to be in a town called The Villages. I myself have never been there. It's actually about an hour away from where Tom lives. It's about an hour from the Orlando International Airport, and they do have shuttles, we're told. So it says international, so I'm sure you can fly in from any place in the country to the Orlando International Airport for an event on February 18th. That's Thursday evening at 5 p.m. That's going to be a Soho Forum debate, and it will be held at the Brownwood Hotel and Spa, a great hotel, I gather, on Brownwood Boulevard in The Villages. And it's going to be a debate between Whole Foods CEO John Mackey versus Ayn Rand Institute Chair Yaron Brook. Fans of the Tom Woods Show will no doubt recall that John Mackey recently appeared on Tom's show talking about his most recent book, Conscious Leadership: Elevating Humanity Through Business. And he will essentially defend the core resolution, the core theme of that book against Yaron Brook. So, you know, he's willing to put his ideas through the ringer before somebody like Yaron, who might be a little cynical about those ideas. You make up your mind about who's right and who has the best argument to make. I should back up and say that I'm excited about it. I'll be down there, and I will be there with my operations head, Jane Menton, my technical head, Brett Ranney, my wife, Fasako, who's been head of catering at the Soho Forum. And this is, again, like a long drink of water after a time on the desert. The last time the Soho Forum had a live event was on March March 11th. Yeah, I remember that well because 2 days after I had lunch with Tom in New York City, and then we had to go into lockdown. We've been pleased to have Zoom events, Zoom debates. We've had 11 Zoom debates over the last 10 months. But the mission of the SOA Forum has always been twofold, not just to hold debates of interest to libertarians, but to have a social occasion, a meet and greet. That's why part of the signature line of those meets and greets was, just say the name Tom Woods to me and you get a free drink at the bar. That lured Tom Woods to come to our debates and lured a lot of other people because a lot of free drinks given out happily to those people who would simply say the words Tom Woods. I'm not sure about where the bar is going to be at the Brownwood Hotel and Spa. So I don't know if I can make good on the Tom Woods promise with respect to a free drink, but I do hope you can all make it. And as an added attraction, Tatiana Moroz, who, if you're familiar with the with Tom's Contra cruises, I think she's on at least two of your cruises, Tom. I know maybe
three. I think she went on all of them, yeah.
All of them, yeah. Well, yeah. She was a featured attraction. She is an accomplished songwriter and singer, and she has consented to do a song or two as a warm-up. Usually, we have a comic. It's invariably been Dave Smith as a warm-up comic before the debate starts. This time, we're working out with Tatiana what's the best song or two for her to sing before the event starts. And she will, of course, be meeting and greeting and mingling with everybody there as well. So go into, that's February 18th, Thursday, go into thesoulforum.org for the full details. And I hope to see you all there.
All right. Excellent. Excellent. I wanted to start off with that because, First of all, the stuff you do, Gene, is really important. I love the SoHo Forum. It's one of the great things about New York, or, you know, and I hope someday will once again be one of the great things about New York. But
yeah,
I think it's also just good for our folks to know that there are things going on they can go do after what they just went through.
Oh, go do in the old-fashioned sense of actually being in the same room with somebody physically. That sort of thing. You know, Tom and I, of course, are lovers of live concerts, live theater, live appearances. Everything live, we want to come alive again. And that's certainly a craving within us all. And we at the SOA Forum want to satisfy the craving I myself feel as well.
All right, let's turn to our subject matter for today. I got an email from somebody describing herself as a relatively new listener of the show. And she said that she was listening to a podcast that I was not familiar with called The Realignment.
Yeah, yeah.
And on that podcast was Eric Weinstein, who I think is with Teal Capital.
Yeah.
And he was talking in the excerpt that she sent about the Trump economy. And she said, I wonder if maybe you might comment on this. So now I'm actually having Gene Epstein on to talk about it. So she's getting a completely distorted view of what it's like to write to Tom Woods, that he answers you and you get a whole episode. That is not how it normally happens, okay?
Tom, I hope you're not going to slap me down for this, but you sent me the email, and she says that a group of friends here in New York are longtime fans of your work, and she says she's here in New York. It doesn't say New York City, but not infrequently when people say New York, they do mean New York City. So my heart leapt. I'm a fan of the Tom Woods show, and she is as well, and she's in New York. We could start a local meeting of the Tom Woods fan club, which we would form. And so I want to give a shout out to her. She apparently lists her name as Jenny Marcus. I'm sure that she doesn't mind having that 15 seconds of fame by being called as such. So Jenny Marcus, this one's for you. And if you're in the neighborhood, look me up. I actually have your email address, so probably I'll just give you a little shout out by email. Jenny Marcus, this is for you. You asked about, I have to correct you, Tom, by the way. It was actually the two guys who run the show before Eric Weinstein came on.
Oh, is it? Okay, then my mistake.
Yeah. They were, and although, of course, the name Eric Weinstein popped out at me because he actually attended one of my SOA Forum debates, although I never met him. He came to my debate with Bhaskar Sankara on socialism, although I never met him. He never came up to say hello to me. And then I discovered that he's one of those sort of technological determinists who thinks capitalism is dead. And so I've written him several times, and actually an assistant of mine called him to ask if he would debate me. So the name stuck out for that reason. But in fact, Eric Weinstein has just been appearing on this show talking about politics. This was those two guys on this show that called themselves New Right Populist. So they were opining on something, and they apparently got their opinions from a column written by New York Times columnist named Ross Douthat. So I looked up the column as well, and I listened to them. Do you now want to play? The question was, let's proceed carefully here. The question that Jenny was interested in, and she's interested in the quality of the answer that these two guys gave, the question that came into these two guys who run this show called The Realignment was, were the accomplishments of the Trump economy due largely to his tax cuts? That was, the questioner thought it was really due largely to his tax cuts. And so they responded to that question, and then they also gave their own pronouncements on what the wonders of the economy, of the Trump economy, really were attributable to. So that's the setup. Do you want to now pause? We're going to play those 70 seconds in which they gave their answer. Tom, we'll do that right now. And then
yes, we'll do that right now. Yeah. Let me start off by saying, yeah, I guess I'm going to have to write to her and ask if she's okay about having her name spoken out on the show, because we are living in cancel culture, Gene. I don't want to get anybody
Tom,
in trouble.
Yes, as that's usual. First... Yeah, yeah. I think I've never appeared on your show, Tom, at least not recently, where you don't have to edit out something indiscreet that I said. Okay.
You know, I should really. That actually would be funny if I had been doing that, because I would bundle all those edited out things and give them to my top supporters as a gift. Okay. The uncensored Gene Epstein. Right. Who wouldn't want that? Yeah. And then secondly, let me just make clear, after your kind invitation to her, just everybody understand that you mean this purely intellectually. Gene's a married man.
Yeah, oh yeah.
He's perfectly happy. Has a wonderful wife, Hisako. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So he just wants to encourage intellectual camaraderie. That's
oh my
all that's
God!
Going on.
You see, Tom, that didn't even remotely occur to me.
You're so ethereal, Gene. Yeah, exactly. You know, you're that's why.
I'm just an innocent guy, innocent of that kind of stuff, Tom, that you know something about. I'm out of it completely. And I'm 76 years old, and those days are gone forever, and so on. So thank you very much for that point as well, Tom. This person need not fear any intent other than to commune and meet somebody who is also a fan of someone's show. Go on, yeah.
All right. Okay, Chris, we're going to play the audio clip right now. Yeah. Here we go, everybody.
Well, the truth is, and you should go back and listen to our Joe Weisenthal episode, is that the broadened distributional effects of the tax cuts did not see an increase in business investment and many of the other promises. To the extent that there was a great economy under the Trump administration, it's for two very specific reasons. Again, media and the GOP establishment don't want to admit this. Number one was a net decrease in the level of immigration to the United States. We had the tightest labor market on record under Donald Trump because of his immigration policies. And second was because of the Federal Reserve and a looser monetary policy, which changed the value of the dollar relative to the rest of the world. Ross Douthat, in his most recent column over at the New York Times, writes about how Trump is probably the only president in modern American history who could have combined immigration restrictionism with looser monetary policy. And to the extent that we had a roaring economy, it was because of increased wages amongst lower wage workers for the first time in almost over 30 years. That comes from that tight labor market. And then on trade and the rest of why we were revving up is because of that monetary policy.
All right, so that was the bit that really summarized what their argument was about the Trump economy. So
yeah,
you want to just summarize what we just heard?
Exactly. Okay, now we're going to proceed like in the old days when Tom used to do Contra Krugman. And I'm going to carry most of the ball. I'm going to be that guy he used to have on and as his pal, who would do the heavy lifting on the economics. And it was his job, Bob Murphy's job. I can mention his name, of course, Bob Murphy's job, to summarize what was said. A couple of times they do say that it was to the extent that it was a great economy. They do think it was a great economy. And they say that it was not the tax cuts, because the tax cuts didn't boost business investment, mainly because of that, didn't boost business investment. So the tax cuts weren't really why there was a great economy. But the two reasons why which they apparently got from this Ross Douthat column. Ross Douthat being, again, a New York Times columnist, is that it was due to the fact that there was a net decrease in immigration to the U.S. under the Trump economy that brought about tightest labor market on record and brought about increased wages. And then it was also due to the loose monetary policy by the Fed. And then there's a general mention, although it wasn't in the Ross Douthat article, a general mention about the dollar. And as nearly as I can determine, they seem to think that the dollar declined in value and that probably made our exports cheaper. I think that's what they meant, pretty sure. Anyway, is that a fair summary of what they said, Tom, as far as you're concerned? Yeah.
It is. Yeah. So where do you want to start on this? First of all, I thought the argument about the decrease in immigration, which led to increased wages for lower wage workers, and that was one of the driving forces of what made the economy good, was so confused. I was shocked. That's not the way a left-wing economist is supposed to analyze this, for one thing, but that's just all screwed up.
I don't know much about Ross Douthat offhand, actually.
No, and I suppose he's supposed to be like right of center, but you know, who knows what that is. I'm sure on economics, that's a thoroughly confused state.
Yeah, no, and these guys are, of course, were excited by that point, and they clearly like the idea of keeping immigrants out. Obviously, there's, I think, a number of interesting things to say about that. But the first one, of course, is that we should just make the very specific sort of Austrian point, I would call that the Austrian point, which is that if you are an immigrant and you have a job in the market economy, and if it's legitimately the market economy, then an Austrian would say that then somebody is therefore buying your services to do something or other. And those people who are buying the services clearly find that the money they offer you in return for those services is worth less than the services they get. In other words, you're producing value for the people you're servicing, be it an employer or if you have your own business. And indeed, the data show that immigrants disproportionately start their own business. And so just for starters, you'd have to say that if it helps a roaring economy to keep immigrants out who might have jobs, who would have jobs in the market economy or start businesses, then that's extremely perverse statement. It proceeds in exactly the opposite direction. We could give that a sort of reductio ad absurdum and say, why did Trump just stop at keeping new immigrants out? Why didn't he just drive all the immigrants out who had jobs in the market economy already? Because
if this kind of argument were right, then wouldn't it, I'm not saying the person favors this, but from an economic standpoint, wouldn't there be a benefit in just arbitrarily killing a million people? Because that would also probably lead to increased wages for lower wage workers. If we kill a lot, we just kill them. Now, that can't be right. Like, there's no way that's economically good, apart from the morality of this. That can't be right.
No, absolutely. And you went me one better on that, Tom. And of course, obviously, these guys don't necessarily want to drive the immigrants out or kill a million people. But of course, in fairness, what we're really saying is we're doing this classic reductio ad absurdum. By implication, if you limit labor, then why stop there? Why not just kill a lot of labor off? Because that means you'll get a tighter labor market, and you'll get a booming economy. So that's completely perverse. I wanted to put a fine point in terms of Austrian economics, because again, you really do find that people think that when somebody takes a job, again, in a market economy, we have to stress that, a legitimate market economy, that somehow or other, you're actually like burdening the economy. Obviously, by definition, from an Austrian standpoint, it's confused by the way, on the part of the mainstream in part, because the mainstream tends to think that there's an equation of exchange, that if I pay Tom Woods $100 for an hour's worth of work, that's an equation. The work that Tom Woods did for me was worth $100, so it's a wash. No, the $100 was worth less to me than the work he did for me. The work he did for me is worth more. That's assuming Tom is the immigrant in this case, for example. So I think it's important to put a fine point on it, because again, even people who's brainwashed by mainstream economics can get these things confused. But I want to go beyond that and point something else out about the sort of appalling nature of the kind of work that, with respect to Ross Douthat and with respect to these young guys who made these pronouncements, what's appalling about it is that they don't know how to look things up. They don't even know, for example, that the Bureau of Labor Statistics has been tracking for years now immigrant labor in the U.S. economy. Again, bear in mind that the argument was that we got this roaring economy because Trump kept out immigrants who would otherwise be taking jobs, and that created a tight labor market. Well, let me cut to the chase with respect to the numbers and then make it clear as to why there's an obvious disconnect in time, in particular, and demographically in general, between saying that Trump kept immigrants out and that meant that fewer immigrants were in the labor force. In particular, the data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics show that from 2016 through 2019, that we're taking this up to 2019 because, of course, 2020 is when bad stuff happened, and that's an outlier on the record of the Trump administration. We don't have data for 2020 with respect to immigrant labor anyway, but the number of immigrants in the labor force grew every year from 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019. It was at 27 million, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in 2016, and it rose to 28.4 million by 2019. As a percentage of the labor force, as conventionally measured by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the immigrants hit a record high of 17.4% in 2018, and then it was also at 17.4% in 2019, which meant it kept pace with the increase in the labor force over those 2 years. So it was at a record high. Now, I could elaborate further. Actually, come to think of it, I should with respect to the data, because this is of interest. Part of the reason why the immigrants, what are the immigrants? The immigrants, by definition, very careful definition, of course, it's from all countries. It's mostly Latinos, many, of course, about 25 to 30% Asians, and it includes people from Puerto Rico and Guam. They point that out, that you're legitimately an immigrant if you come from Puerto Rico. But I guess now it's a good moment to point out, perhaps you begin to realize the obvious problem with pointing out that when you keep immigrants out in 2017 or 2018, you necessarily have an immediate impact on the labor force. Number one, you're mostly keeping out women and children. And women among the foreign-born, in particular, women among the foreign-born, among the immigrants, have a lower labor force participation rate than natives do. And so it's mainly the men among the immigrants who take jobs. And in 2019, for example, the most recent year, 78% of foreign-born men were in the labor force, 78% compared to 67.4% for the native-born. But interestingly, the women who are foreign-born have a lower labor force participation rate. But on balance, there's a much higher labor force participation rate among men. So therefore, to begin with, you want to talk about, well, how many men who are old enough to take jobs in the labor force did you keep out? And then, of course, the obvious point is that you already have a critical mass of immigrants in the economy. You're not driving them out. And so as they come of age, from the age of 16 to 17 to 18 to 20 years old, as the years go on from 2016 to 2019, shouldn't be surprised if you get an increase, even though you're keeping immigrants out. So perhaps I made that point clear. It's very possible that Trump's policy means that in 2021 or 2022 or 2023, he's going to have some influence on the number, his policies would have some impact on the number and share of immigrants in the labor force. But clearly, it takes time to do that. And so that's a little lesson in demographics and statistics. I hope I made it reasonably clear, Tom, or do you have a question about it?
That stuff is well taken and pretty good.
Yeah,
I think for some people, the Federal Reserve stuff can be tricky to deal with because they're saying the Federal Reserve, what they said was the Federal Reserve loosened monetary policy and this weakened the dollar compared with the rest of the world. Yeah. Oh, and I guess, what is the argument that boosts exports or something like that? Like, is that the best they can do? Is that what they're saying? Exports.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, yeah. I want to just tie the ribbon on the immigrant point and only say that, in fact, the Trump economy benefited from the huge wave of immigrants. The 17.4% of the labor force is actually very comparable to the big wave of immigration that goes back to my grandparents around 1910 when immigration was open. There's been a revolution in immigration, and Trump was unable to stop its impact on the labor force by simply keeping immigrants out. So therefore, to tie the ribbon on it, when you have more people pursuing productive labor in the economy, that's a good thing. That benefits people. People are buying their services, getting value out of it, and that obviously boosted economic growth. So the statistics and the insight are exactly the opposite of what these young guys said, taking their argument from Ross Douthat. Now, to get to the next part of your, of it, Tom, with respect to monetary policy, the point about monetary policy is that by any conventional measure, monetary policy under Trump was not looser, but tighter. And so I found that almost all the more peculiar. Again, part of the problem with what Ross Douthat said and what these young guys asserted is that they didn't cite any data. But if you look up any conventional measure, which I'm going to go over in a moment, then you find that that is exactly the case. Now, people read the papers. They might have noticed that the Federal Reserve was maintaining the interest rate at 0% for a number of years under Obama. And then the final year under Obama, they began to hike the interest rate. Now, let me back up and say, one conventional way of thinking about the tightness or looseness of monetary policy is the thing that gets reported in the press all the time and does have some legitimacy in terms of measuring monetary policy. That's the federal funds rate, the target on the overnight lending rate between banks that the Fed has traditionally targeted. And the Fed started to raise rates under Obama and then continued to do so under Trump. And so I jotted some numbers down. The average effective Fed funds rate under Trump for 3 years from 2016 through 2019 was 1.66%. Under Obama, for the prior 3 years under Obama, I'm going to compare the 3 years prior under Obama with the 3 years that Trump followed with so that we have a reasonably comparable period. And under Obama, the average Fed funds rate was 0.21%. So far lower under Obama. Monetary policy by that criterion, and I think it's up to a point a legitimate one, tightened under Trump, did not loosen. And then the other conventional measure that is used, because it harkens back to Milton Friedman, who preferred the measure of the money supply known as M2, a broader measure of money than just cash and checking deposits known as M1, that under Trump, the money supply increased by 5.1% a year over those 3 years from 2016 to 2020. Under Obama, it increased at a faster rate at 6.2%. So again, money was increasing at a faster rate under Obama than under Trump. In that sense, there was a tightening, not a loosening. There's another measure that's been invented a number of years ago called MZM. It's supposed to be the best measure of ready cash. And there too, growth in MZM slowed under Trump and slowed under Trump after he took over from Obama. Again, under Obama, it increased by an annual rate of 6.1%. Under Trump, it slowed to an annual rate of 5.2%. But again, I was surprised that they could even make this statement because I thought that most people who sort of superficially read the papers are aware of the Fed funds rate and the Fed's announcements about tightening. And so I was surprised that they could even make that statement because, again, that's when the Federal Reserve did begin to hike the Fed funds rate, when Obama was about to, in final year of Obama, and continued to do so through most of the years of the Trump administration under review. And so that, too, is crazy.
Hey, folks, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsor, Blinkist, and I want to pay Blinkist a high compliment. We're living at a time when diversity of opinion is not exactly being encouraged everywhere you look, but Blinkist is a noble exception. Old Woods here is always recommending new books for you to read. I'm having authors on all the time. You wonder, how am I going to read them all? Well, one way to manage all that is with this amazing app, Blinkist. It takes the key ideas and insights from thousands of nonfiction bestsellers and gathers them together in 15-minute text and audio explainers that help you understand more about the core ideas. And then you can find out if this is a book you want to read in its entirety or if it wouldn't really be worth your time. I like Blinkist because if I drive 30 minutes one way and 30 minutes home, I can consume the equivalent of 4 books. I recommend you check out this very interesting book, Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker, which I listened to on Blinkist. But you'll also find great libertarian classics like Capitalism and Freedom by Milton Friedman and For a New Liberty by Murray Rothbard. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods. Well, I think a lot of people have been led to believe for some reason, maybe not professional economists, although even some of them, but let's say the average person who doesn't really know that much probably thinks that loose monetary policy is a net benefit for the economy. I think that's what Trump thinks.
Yes.
I mean, Trump knows some things about business.
Yeah.
In terms of economics, he doesn't know a whole lot, but not a lot less than George W. Bush knew, or McCain said he had Alan Greenspan's book and he was going to read it because he didn't know enough economics. I mean, it's just embarrassing.
Yeah.
So I think the average person thinks, well, anything that involves, quote, stimulating the economy has to be a good thing. Mm-hmm. And Trump says, I like low interest rates and so on. So I think people hear loose monetary policy and they think, well, good, this will help create some kind of expansion. Because even the word, you know, like the word tight, it just sounds like a, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody who just refuses to be abundant. You know, we have all this potential abundance, and instead you just want to be tight.
Tom, it's practically a Jewish word. I can educate you about that, about my culture, Tom. You know, who's tight? You know, Uncle Abe, to some extent, people who are miserly, who give very...
Miserly is the word, yes.
Maybe tips. They don't tip very heavily at restaurants. They're constantly snoring from... They're tight. That's an old... It's practically a Yiddish word. Absolutely, Tom, you're right. Even more right than you know. That's my point. Go ahead.
Okay, I appreciate that. So that's partly why I wanted you to come on and talk about
sorry,
this.
John. Okay.
Because people are just led to think that loose monetary, it sounds good, right? Why wouldn't low interest rates sound good to somebody?
Yes. Well, absolutely. And of course, when you talk about, let me digress. You know that funny old story about John F. Kennedy, who was supposed to be a very bright president, you know, very intellectual, and he could never figure who was in charge of federal fiscal policy and monetary policy. So they gave him a mnemonic. William McChesney Martin was the head of the Fed. So they said, think M, McChesney Martin. So that's monetary policy. That's as far as Kennedy went with it. But you're absolutely right, Tom, that that's the basic view. And you're correct in a way to say, hey, maybe in the presentation I just made, I should have given it the same framework that I gave the point about the immigrants. I just did a deep dive into the numbers and used, you know, 3 conventional measures and pointed out that actually by the conventional measures that the mainstream respects, and I think have some validity, monetary policy was actually tighter under Trump than under Obama. But now to get to your larger point and the very term tight, I want to put nuance on it, which I think you would appreciate, Tom. It is potentially true that if you lower interest rates to 0%, potentially, if you aggressively expand the money supply, you might be able to bring about conventionally measured growth that would be a bit higher than otherwise. But the different versions of this, certainly the Austrian version of the dangers of doing that are that you're going to pay for it down the road. You're going to bring about a bubble. You're going to bring about malinvestment, and the economy is going to crash as a result. But I can also use sort of the mainstream comment. By now it's mainstream that if you start doing that, you're going to overheat the economy, and that the Federal Reserve's classic job is to take the punch bowl away when the party's about to start. So that, therefore, even most mainstream economists would tend to agree that it's rather dangerous to try to goose up growth by expanding the money supply or maintaining interest rates low, even to the extent that you might succeed in doing that. So that I imagine you'd agree that that's those are the nuance to it, that looser monetary policy could conceivably bring about some increase in conventionally measured growth. However, it's the other analogy, the other metaphor, which many associate themselves with, not just Austrians, are that you're giving the economy heroin, and then it's got to go to the methadone clinic once it crashes. That you're getting the economy drunk. That's the punch bowl analogy. So all of that is fairly well understood. And it's unfortunate that, again, that these young guys thought, well, looser monetary policy, seemingly from the way they were commenting on it, it's nothing but a good thing. It's even, again, to emphasize, you might say there's a particle of truth in the idea that looser economic policy could bring some increase in conventionally measured growth, but you pay for it later on. So it's not a smart idea. Or to put a finer point on the way we Austrians would put it, the whole idea of Soviet planning for the interest rates in the economy, one of the most important prices of all, the price of credit, the whole idea that those prices should be planned by a central agency, that's Soviet type economics, and maintaining very low interest rates, lower interest rates than the market would determine them to be, is a very dangerous policy that could bring bad stuff later on. But again, you'd expect that these young guys would at least understand the conventional objection that you get the economy high and that's not a good idea. So even apart from that, indeed, you're right that to talk about how we had this great and roaring economy because of looser monetary policy and what a great achievement on the part of the Trump administration. If you recall in the recording, what they say is that as Ross Douthat said, only Donald Trump could bring about these two things at the same time: keep out the immigrants and print money. You know, all these two marvelous things that bring about a roaring economy. And so, I guess you agree with what I just said, Tom.
I do. And it actually, even though I've probably taken up all the time of yours I can rightfully ask for.
Well, what are you talking about, Tom? No, Tom, I got a lot more to say here. But
yeah, I know. Of course, you're Gene Epstein, right? Well, what I want to ask you is, all right, so we've poked some holes in this clip that we heard.
Yeah, yeah.
But what would be, now that the Trump era is coming to an end, what would be your assessment, not responding to other people, but your spontaneously created assessment of the Trump economy, the good, the bad, and the causes of the good or the bad?
The good, the bad, and the ugly is what I used to call it, Tom.
Yeah.
Still call it that. You know, that's exactly what I wanted to talk about. I had actually been toying with whether I would just give my overall framework before plunging in. But since we quoted these guys, we should be consistent with the great old days of Contra Krugman and respond specifically to what they said, and now give the larger view, and then of course you'll ask me anything more that you want to say, and then just like you used to do with Bob Murphy. So this will be a great nostalgic time for you, Tom. I want to start with this framework and put it this way. I still do look closely every September when the Economic Freedom Index is updated by the Fraser/Cato Institute. Mainly comes from the Fraser Institute. You know, Walter Blaus, you probably know, that was interesting. It was kind of an interesting collaboration, this quantitative measure, between Milton Friedman, I might say, and Walter Block, because, Walter actually worked with the Fraser Institute for a while, and of course, Milton Friedman helped inspire the measure. And it's a general measure of economic freedom across five different criteria, and the most important one being legal system and property rights. One of the honest things that they do is recognize that since they have so much data to compile, they always have to be behind the times. They can never be very current on the Economic Freedom Index. And I think it's unfortunate the Wall Street Journal/Heritage Foundation issues updated measures, but these updated measures are unfortunately just guesses. The Economic Freedom Index this past September, released by the Fraser Institute, was through 2018, and at least it shows some marker, and this is the general judgment. Then 2018, of course, being basically 2 years into the Trump economy, so it tells us something about what Trump was up to the extent that Trump was affecting the economy at all. And the news is not good. The Economic Freedom Index actually, to give you a historical perspective, interestingly enough, it rose in the U.S. every decade from 1970 through 2000. And that's an interesting sort of bipartisan story that could be elaborated on. It reached, the Economic Freedom Index rose from 1970 to 1980, from 80 to 90, and from 1990 to 2000. It hit a peak of 8.67 on a scale of 0 to 10. And 8.67 is pretty good. Although, again, I should say that the numbers, even that maximum of 10 is marked on a curve. It's not exactly, even if it got a 10, the U.S. economy got a 10, it would not be what we libertarians / Austrians call the most amount of economic freedom you can possibly have in an economy, but it would be pretty good. 8.67 is pretty good as well. It then fell from 2000 on, and in 2016, that's the last year of the Obama administration. It had fallen. It actually hit a low and then creeped up a bit under Obama, which is interesting. But by 2016, it was at 8.32. 8.32 versus 8.67, nearly half a point of loss. So that was clearly something that explained why economic growth had slowed in the 16 years from 2000 to 2016. And then under Trump, that 8.32 ticked down even further to 8.22 by 2018. A very small decrease, but it obviously meant that Trump was not about to bring about a turnaround in the U.S. Economic Freedom Index. Even more depressingly, the most crucial measure, subset, subcomponent of economic freedom that almost is sufficient to correlate with economic growth across countries on its own, is what's called legal system and property rights. And that had plummeted from 8.35 in 2000 to 7.46, around nearly a 9/10 of a point fall from under Obama by 2016. That's 8.35 in 2000 down to 7.46 in 2016. And it again ticked down further under Trump to 7.33. So the best you can say about what Trump did was the Economic Freedom Index in general didn't exactly collapse under Trump. It didn't do that much worse than it had done under Obama, but he certainly did not bring about, from a free market perspective, anything that you'd want. Again, if anything, the Economic Freedom Index ticked down. And I do think that it's a useful index and tells us a lot. And that probably explains why you have to scratch hard to find anything in the Trump economy that made much of a difference compared to what was going on under Obama. The two different measures of growth, one in the private sector, the other just in the private sector, the 3 years under Trump from 2016 to 2019, it ran 2.2% in the private sector GDP. Under Obama, the 3 years prior, it ran 2.2%. Exactly the same under Trump. The broader measure of GDP growth was 2.5% under Trump. For those 3 years under Obama, it was 2.4%, too negligible to make any difference. And so nothing really happened. We had basically subpar growth under both administrations, under Obama and under Trump. I mean, the only thing that did happen, which is why the naive, I'll pause for a moment there, Tom, and ask if you have any comment or elaboration, because I was going to go on to talk about what happened to the unemployment rate and to the labor markets, because that's the thing that impresses the naive the most. That's my next point. But
go ahead to that. Sure. We have talked about the Economic Freedom Index in the past, and that's actually been a useful lens for understanding what's really going on, because sometimes you get people saying the economy does better under Democrats than Republicans, which is just like the kind of thing a midwit would say.
Yeah.
But then when you look at where the Economic Freedom Index is going, which is more significant than whether Democrats or Republicans are in charge, the results tend to make more sense. But anyway, you carry on.
Yeah. Well, no, and actually, since you may, I want to emphasize what's interesting about the Economic Freedom Index is that it's based upon objective numbers, the one that's compiled by the Fraser Institute, that they use. Every source is footnoted. Every source is available. You can reconstruct it on your own. But part of it is that because they are so specific about only using numbers that are available, The softer numbers, you might say, that they use are often surveys of business people that come up with numbers. So that, you might say, that's the softer numbers. But since they use a broad sample of different questions that from different sources, it adds up to a very good mosaic. But part of the point then is that then if you ask them, well, what was it that happened? Why did this go down? Why did that go down? Then to some extent, it's conjectural because we only know that number went down and then we can give it some explanations for it. So that's the odd thing about it and why a testament to its strength because it is objective and nobody can finagle with it, but also because it's so objective, explaining it is sometimes difficult. But then to go back to your Democrat and Republican point, Tom, we do have to at least point out and emphasize that the progress of the Economic Freedom Index in the 70s, 80s, and 90s was a bipartisan story, which is interesting in itself. But getting beyond that, now let's get to the unemployment rate and tell this story. When an expansion continues for a long time. In this case, the U.S. economy was climbing out of a 10% unemployment rate that had been suffered in the wake of the 2008-2009 Great Recession. The unemployment rate hit about 10% in 2009. And what conventionally happens in the U.S. economy is that the unemployment rate comes down slowly. Now, that's not what you'd want or what you'd expect in a truly free market economy. But there's so many different kinds of obstacles to reemploying people as the economy begins to bounce back that and that's a slow process. And when you have, in the case of the 3 years that I'm comparing, the last 3 years under Obama with the 3 years that followed under Trump, in the beginning of the three-year period under Obama, the unemployment rate had fallen to 7.4%. 7.4%. Again, unacceptable from any standpoint, certainly unacceptable from the standpoint of any of us who believe in free market economics. So 7.4%, as conventionally measured, clearly means labor slack. And I don't think it's too surprising that you have to bring the unemployment rate down to begin to benefit people of very limited skills, low-wage people, that just to employ them, just for the economy to be doing well enough or for nominal revenue to be high enough to be able to get over the hurdle of the minimum wage, takes time because the unemployment rate takes time to fall. And because the unemployment rate is at 7.4% because the economy isn't quite there, you're still not even giving these people jobs or giving them raises. So that's what conventionally happens. You have to see an unemployment rate coming down to the 4% region, to the 3% region, before you get pretty universal increases in wages. With that said, I maybe overstated the point because wages were increasing through most of these years, but there was an acceleration of wage growth once the unemployment rate began to get to the 4% region. It hit 4.9% by the last month of Obama's economy, and then it continued to decline. And actually, there's a slower decline. The labor market begins to get tight. Job openings begin to expand. It's harder to find workers. So the unemployment rate from December 2016 to December 2019 fell from 4.9% to 3.7%. Only a 1.2% decline over those 3 years, but that's conventionally what happens in the U.S. economy, a slower decline. But once you get down to the 4% region and then below the 4% region, then you hit a tight labor market, and that's what occurred under Trump. And so then the very thing then that these guys were talking about, which is that low-wage workers saw special increases in their wages. But of course, they're associating that's the consumer fallacy. They literally say that low-wage workers are earning more, and that's why the economy is booming. Well, I'm happy that low-wage workers are earning more, but obviously the economy is doing better. It's not booming. 2.5% growth is dismal by almost any standard. It's not terrible. There is economic progress. People get more. It is growth, I would insist, but it's certainly nothing to write home about. However, what these people get excited about is that once you're at that point in an expansion and the unemployment rate gets down to a tighter labor market, that everybody benefits hugely, and that's what's been credited to Trump. But really, the only thing that that I haven't accounted for, which is where I know that there would be differing opinions on all sides, and where I don't really have a good response is that the boom, the expansion did continue under Trump. In other words, Austrians might have expected, and indeed, as you know, if I may mention, David Stockman and Peter Schiff were expecting a collapse for years. It didn't happen. The economy continued to grow, albeit at a modest pace. It grew at a modest pace, nothing impressive. And the Wall Street Journal most recently, at the Wall Street Journal editorial page, has tried to credit Trump with having given the expansion legs. They get into crazy metaphors about how the expansion is tired, like it's an aging guy, like a middle-aged guy like Tom Woods at the age of 48, and you're getting tired. And so they give you a shot of adrenaline, as though that metaphor fits the U.S. economy. Obviously, the U.S. economy is just different people doing different things. Some of us die out. Businesses go bankrupt. New businesses start. The U.S. economy is not an individual. So you might say that something like the idea that the expansion continued under Trump, and maybe you want to give him credit for that, although I don't see how you can. But I want to say that I can't give a full explanation as to why the expansion continued. But then I only want to say that because the expansion continued, you had what normally happens, a decline in the unemployment rate, a tighter labor market resulting, and then low-wage workers benefiting especially. So that's really what you had. And it was not a roaring economy. It was pretty much of a rather conventional, dismal story about a progressing economy. We could do far better. I'd like to repeat that the U.S. economy, if it really were a free market, if it really had 10 plus on the Economic Freedom Index, we should be growing at 7% a year. We should be doubling. 7% means you're doubling output every 10 years. That's really the kind of economy we would have if we had a free market. We had 2.5%, nothing to write home about. And so that's ultimately the judgment that I would make on the Trump administration. I guess in a more limited way, to return to the point about the Economic Freedom Index, I would say to all people like those at the Wall Street Journal, those more conventional free market types, if Trump actually had done something, then I'd want you to be able to point to the idea that he raised the Economic Freedom Index. I'll stipulate that we only have the 2018 number. We don't have 2019 or 2020, but I would be astonished if we get any real improvement in that index in subsequent years, as recorded by the Fraser Institute. So again, I give Trump pretty much the same grade I give Obama.
All right. And with that, we'll wrap things up and remind people about, well, first of all, the website, thesohoforum.org,
yes,
you should just know about. Because
and then also my all news about what I'm up to and what's going on with my Soho Forum. We're going to have another Zoom debate in March. We will have another live debate in April. And I think maybe Tom, I don't know if Tom's going to be able to come to that one. But
You better believe I'll be okay there, because you're one of the debaters in that one.
Well, thank you, Tom. Yeah, okay, Tom's going to get his free drink at the bar. I've guaranteed him. I'm going to find a bar and we're going to give Tom a free drink. Tom will be there. That's in April. And all of those notices and those updates, again, thesohoforum.org is the best place to go for Soho Forum news. But other updates and things to come and other stuff I'm up to is at Gene Soho Forum. At Gene Soho Forum is my Twitter handle.
Okay, so I'll put all that stuff on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1817, because you should know about the Soho Forum, you should know about what's coming up, you should try to attend in-person events when possible, not only to support the Soho Forum, but to support your own mental health. So go check all that out. And Gene, as always, and by the way, here's some interesting thing about Gene Epstein, the only guest I have who does this. When I wrap up the episode and I say, thanks a lot, I stop recording. And then I say to the person something like, okay, that was really good. You know, that's going to come out on Tuesday, and I appreciate you doing it. And maybe we have a little chit-chat, and then we go. But when I say, all right, thanks a lot, Gene, right here on the air, he hangs up. He's gone. So he's not there for me to say, hey, that was really good. He has got other things to do.
Oh, hey, Tom, come on. Yeah, Tom, that's been very rude of me. I'm glad you said that.
No, it's funny.
Okay.
I love all your quirks and idiosyncrasies, Gene.
Okay, Tom. Anyway.
Okay. I insist you hang up as soon as I say thank you for being here.
Exactly,
all right.
Tom.
Thanks for being here, Gene. We'll see you later.
Thank you, Tom. Bye-bye.
All right, folks. If you like and appreciate what I'm doing over here, make sure and become a supporting listener of the show, because one of the benefits you get is membership in the Tom Woods Show Elite, which is a fantastic group of wonderful people, exactly the kind of people you wish the whole world were populated by. It is a place of refuge, a place of intellectual stimulation. It's where you belong. If you like the Tom Woods Show, you're not in the Tom Woods Show Elite, you should have your head examined. So head over to supportinglisteners.com. We're not on Facebook anymore. We're on MeWe, and it's working out great. So check it out, supportinglisteners.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.